Session 231. Why I Stay. This is the eighth edition of Why I Stay Sunstone Symposium. We started it 8 years ago sort of in response to a talk that was given in general conference by one of the general authorities, who I don't remember, who suggested that people who can't really abide by what the church does, really should leave, shouldn't be around. And I thought about that. I didn't agree with that then, and I don't now. And so I sort of said, why don't we have a panel of people who are staying in spite of perhaps not being totally welcome in the church for one reason or another, or not feeling comfortable, and why they stay. And it's been well received. I spoke at that first one, and I've just been always found a lot of food for my soul from the things that the people have said who have come after that. They're just wonderful. They've had experiences about where they've struggled and what keeps them in to wherever they are in the relationship to the church. So we'll proceed with the eighth edition this year, and presumably we'll probably have another next year too. We have five wonderful panelists, all of whom are been actively involved in the church for many years. Most of them, I think, probably born into it. They're also very accomplished in their professions and their day-to-day lives and in their married lives too. So we're very happy to have them here, and they will proceed in the order in which they are in the program. Alan Eastman will be first. And Alan has lived around the church in different places, but he's back in Salt Lake now. You're retired, aren't you?
Sort of.
Sort of retired, yeah. He'll be followed by Carol Quist, who is really the heart and soul of Sunstone in a lot of ways. She's the guy that... she deserves that. And third will be Mark Thomas, who has had a very interesting relationship with the church. He was the director of Sunstone, and then had to bail out of that and went to the Y to teach. When he knew that the president of the Y wouldn't talk to him because of some things that he had written that were heretical. I never could understand that. Fourth will be Susan Werner, who comes with us from a very long, prestigious career as a mother, a homemaker, and 48 years with that, and I think she's got a strange story to tell. And then finally, Ron Fredrickson, who's had some very interesting church roles. He's in the drama business, and I think he got into certain sections, certain dramatic roles that had very high visibility in the church. Is that true?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll leave it at that.
Years ago.
When it was easier to be a devil. Anyway, so we'll go in that order, and I'll ask them again, as I did originally, please stick with the 15-minute limit we've given you, so that those of you who go first don't infringe on the time of others. If when they finish, we have some time for questions, we'll have to go there.
Is this one better?
Yes.
Yeah.
Just have to talk right into it.
Okay. I'll go ahead and use this one if that's all right. I can loaf a little bit anyway. Would it be better to stand? I can do that. Does this one actually work? Okay. Problem solved. Well, I like to pace while I'm talking. This isn't going to work. Anyway, unlike most Sunstoners, seem to be liberal arts sorts of people, I'm a scientist by training, occupation, and inclination. You need to know that one of the chief characteristics of scientists is the curiosity of a 5-year-old. I just kind of like to know everything about everything, and the more the better. And like many 5-year-olds, besides the curiosity, I'm a collector. For example, I have two jackets that are just coated with little cloth patches of places I've been, and then I have another drawer full of patches that haven't yet found a home. I also collect aphorisms, and one that's particularly relevant to the distribution of personalities at Sunstone comments on scientists' tendencies to specialize and liberal arts' drive to expand their conclusions to cover more intellectual ground. They go, scientists learn more and more about less and less, until finally they know everything about nothing. Philosophers, on the other hand, learn less and less about more and more, until finally they know nothing about everything. Being both a scientist and a musician, perhaps my fate is to end up knowing either everything about everything or nothing at all, and the jury's still out. As a matter of fact, I find that as I get older, I believe more and more in less and less. Henry Eyring's father advised him on his departure for university training in the Ivy League. Remember, Henry, in this church, we don't have to believe anything that isn't true. I've happily appropriated that remark as a personal motto. And my life in the church has amounted to trying to find the eternal truths kind of hidden in the institutional wrapping. Perhaps the starting point was when I was in high school and I really looked forward to the seminary curriculum year that was church history. I really wanted to know some details, dates, places, characters of the people, and so on, that never seemed to be given in Sunday school. Well, I found out rather quickly that very little real history was taught in seminary. What we got was the same old lessons, mostly on words of wisdom and chastity, but the moralistic stories were drawn from church history rather than from the scriptures or conference talks. I was pretty disappointed and started at that point to look at church curriculum material with a little bit of suspicion. Despite my hopes, even the ostensibly higher level classes at the university's Institute of Religion were only marginally better. My disappointment with the regular curriculum was only compounded when my home ward called Paul Hodson, vice president of the university, as the young adult teacher. His class was intellectually stimulating, spiritually enriching, and just plain interesting. In short, it was everything that seminary and institute were not, and it showed me that it is really actually possible to have a testimony in the brain at the same time. Meanwhile, across the street from the institute, I was learning the scientific method. You all know how they say it works. You carefully make a hypothesis. You set up an experiment to prove or disprove the hypothesis. You carry out the experiment and then thoughtfully analyze the results and repeat. In principle, the outcome is a steady increase in knowledge. This leads directly to another of my favorite aphorisms. In principle, principle and practice are identical. In practice, they aren't. Well, after earning a bachelor's degree and a PhD in chemistry at the University of Utah, I got a job as a research scientist for Phillips 66 in Oklahoma and started finding out just what practicing science is all about. It wasn't what I thought, nor was it what I'd been taught in high school and college. Science in the real world is somewhat messier. Practice differs substantially from principle. My field, in the beginning at least, was catalysis. Now, for those of you who always stayed as far away from chemistry as you can get, a catalyst is a compound that initiates or facilitates a chemical reaction without itself coming out of the reaction change. In practice, catalysts in the petroleum industry are sort of little synthetic rocks that you stuff in those great big tubes that you can see as you drive past a refinery. What happens is you take crude oil or some fraction of the oil and you put it into those, you heat it up, put it into those tubes, sometimes adding something like hydrogen. And in principle, something good happens with the catalyst mixed in. You already know what's going to happen without the catalyst. You're going to get road tar or coke or charcoal or something that's not really very saleable. But if you've got the right catalyst and the right conditions, you can make gasoline out of that road tar or take the sulfur out of diesel fuel or make gasoline from butane. Sounds good, and it is good. And it's a lot of fun to do in the laboratory, and even more fun if something you develop ends up being really useful. The problem is that it's also pretty difficult. Even after about a century of research in petroleum catalysts, we still know all too little about how it really works, except in the simplest cases. It's still very much a trial and error. Gee, I've got a good feeling about this kind of thing. Some days I felt like I should trade my lab coat for a big black robe with moons and stars on it, and a pointed hat and a wand. Well, why am I telling you all this? Well, it turns out there can be quite a lag time between brewing up a new test catalyst in the lab and getting the results back. And of course, you can't just wait for the results of one test before you make more catalysts, since you have to look busy or the boss gets really nervous. Well, you have to keep your mind in a number of different places in a number of different experimental directions, usually without knowing which ones are really going to work. But you have to act on the punitive success of some experiments before the results are in. And of course, the results aren't always clear-cut. There's a maxim in our lab that success is seldom marked by somebody yelling, "Eureka!" What usually happened when something really went well is that somebody looked at a lab book and scratched their head and said, "Gee, that's funny." Well, all in all, it sounds a lot like life. Most of the results, most of the answers aren't clear-cut, and it can be a long time after the experiment before you know what the right answer really was. Neil Maxwell once said that most of the big decisions in life have to be made on the basis of insufficient evidence. Those of us in second marriages, incidentally, have a fair amount to say about that one. The coping strategy developed by scientists is really pretty simple. You remember that in science, something is held to be true only until it can be shown to be false, so that what we know is, in some sense, always tentative. The strategy, then, is to learn how to regard most things as true for the moment, defining truth as what agrees with experiment. That works pretty well most of the time, but it's not without problems. And the problems that arise have a lot to do with why I, as a scientist, can also be happy as a practicing Mormon. What happens if two contradictory things are both true, as far as we can tell? Well, that's a situation that arises in science from time to time, but it's also common when both science and faith address the same issue. Let me give you an example from science. Consider the case of light. For many years, light was considered to be wave-like in form and composition. It's easy to see that light can be diffracted by raindrops or prism into separate wavelengths, colors, if you will. There's a well-developed body of mathematics that can beautifully describe and predict almost everything about the behavior of light as waves. In short, it's true that light can be considered to be made up of waves. On the other hand, there are some situations where light clearly acts differently as discrete particles. For example, Millikan proved Einstein's postulate that the energy in a light beam, rather than being distributed through space as a wave, comes in little packets. Compton proved in 1921 that a photon in collision with an electron acts like a particle with things like kinetic energy and momentum. Well, is light a wave or a particle? The only conceivable answer is yes. Well, with respect to light, scientists have to hold in their mind simultaneously two contradictory truths. How light has to be defined depends on how you look at it, the kind of question you ask, and how you determine the answer to that question. Is truth then relative rather than absolute? Well, in science, how matter behaves depends on the situation, and that's the absolute truth. Now, I find that in some ways, science and religion are very much the same. What you perceive as the truth depends on the questions you ask, and the path you take to determine the answers to those questions. A few years ago, Stephen Jay Gould defined science and religion as what he called non-overlapping magisteria. He defined a magisterium as a, quote, a domain where one form of teaching holds appropriate tools for meaningful discourse and resolution of questions. In other words, science and faith use different tools to formulate, ask, and answer different questions about reality. Some have criticized Gould's formulation, but I find it a pretty useful way to grasp and handle truth in whatever form it appears, from whatever source. I've spent a career trying to tease the truth from Mother Nature in the laboratory in the field, and frankly, there are few things comparable to knowing that you're the first person in the history of mankind to have discovered something about the world we live in and how it works. I've also been active in the church since my youth. I've discovered that the thrill of spiritual discovery is one of those very few comparable experiences. Here's how it works.
Hear you, Alan.
Okay, here's the things. It's hard to, yeah. Here's how it works for me. By and large, science is capable of answering questions of how the world works and describing physical, chemical, biological processes that act in and on our universe. To me, it's part of that wonderful process of evolution in which we believe as Latter-day Saints that we can evolve from humanity to Godhood. Science is very, very good at formulating and answering those physical kinds of questions. But it's not particularly good in handling questions of behavior in the inner spiritual life. For those questions, the scientific method is not appropriate. In fact, it doesn't work at all. It's, for one thing, it's difficult to design experiments to give unequivocal results about, for example, the power of prayer. There are just too many variables you can't constrain. Yet in my own life, I've had experiences and felt influences that I'm convinced weren't the results of my own wishful thinking, but came from outside myself. I've learned from experience when the Spirit is trying to tell me something, or when I've done the right thing, even when the right thing isn't what my own mental powers have envisioned. Unlike in the lab, I haven't been able to reproduce those things at will. The methods of spiritual research and the results are quite different from those of scientific research. Yet both give truth. Sometimes the results are seemingly contradictory, like light as a particle in a wave. But I found that each approach is useful in its place. I read an interesting talk by Truman Madsen, who, when a recent PhD graduate in philosophy, was quizzed by a student as to how he, Madsen, could still be an active Mormon. Madsen asked his interrogator a series of questions to try and uncover not the questioner's degree of, quote, activity in the church, but his level of spiritual experience, the extent to which he participated in spiritual life, not just showing up at meetings. The key point to me was Madsen's final response to the student. The difference between you and me is not so much the various experiences we have studied or sought to master. The difference is that I've had some experiences that you haven't had. And that means that you're not about to leave the church, as you say. You've never really been in it. He resented that and told me he had several standard quorum awards, but I said, no, the church's flowing powers have not really been in you, whatever you did on Sundays. Basically, people like that student have never removed their spiritual training wheels, so they have no idea what it feels like to move along without them. But once felt, neither riding a bike nor feeling the Spirit can ever be completely forgotten, even though we may set it aside. Now, one of my personal problems with the non-overlapping magisterial approach is that it tends to separate science and faith, even though I, like most people, perceive significant interaction between the two. Einstein is said to have famously remarked, "Science without religion is lame, and religion without science is blind." Are you, still not? Okay, I'm sorry. Let me hold this. This will work better.
Just louder.
Just louder. Okay. My own favorite solution to the problem is found in a discourse by Father Lehi from 2 Nephi. "For it must needs be that there is an opposition in all things. If not so, righteousness could not be brought to pass, neither wickedness nor holiness nor misery, neither good nor bad. Wherefore all things must needs be a compound in one." I take this to mean that our lives interact with many different continua, many different sets of value scales. For example, in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve were presented with the option to start confronting good and evil, opposite ends of a spectrum. That's only the first of the continua that mankind has had to face. I consider these issues continua because we seldom have to deal with, for example, absolute evil or perfect good. There's always some mix, some place along a scale between one end of the continuum and the other, some shade of gray rather than pure black or pure white. Consider faith versus works, light, darkness, male, female, knowledge, faith, sickness, health, action, contemplation, principle, practice, obedience, freedom, rest, work, and a host of others, including, by the way, science and religion. At any moment we care to look, we find ourselves somewhere along each one of these continuum. Our personal identity can be described as the sum total of all the values we exhibit for those continuum in our lives. In other words, as Lehi puts it, our lives are a compound in one of all those continuum, all those factors. I think it'd make a really interesting paper to use some statistical techniques I use for data analysis to try and put people in groups. It'd be a lot of fun. It's called the hierarchical cluster analysis, if you're interested. Now, I'm running out of time, and we're finally getting back to where we started this talk. Why do I stay? Is there conflict between science and faith, both of which strongly affirm the truth of sometimes contradictory positions? Yes, but remember the wave versus particle discussion. The non-overlapping magisteria approach has allowed me to accept truth from science using one set of rules, asking one type of question to discover one set of answers, while using faith with its different set of rules and different questions to obtain a different set of answers. I find I'm not willing to give up on either methodology because the answers I get from each one tend to be intellectually and spiritually satisfying. I've learned a lot from both methods. And remember, we don't have to believe anything in this church that isn't true. Is the organizational church sometimes difficult, misguided, exasperating, and just plain wrong? Absolutely. As I said at the beginning, I find I'm believing more and more and less. The core of the matter, the atonement of the Savior, is becoming more and more important, and a lot of other things are falling away because they're so much less significant in the long run. To be completely honest, sometimes it's difficult to reconcile what I've learned by faith and what I've learned from science. But the grand experiment is not yet over, and the boss gets nervous if he doesn't see us busy. So I'll stick it out until I really know whenever that is. Remember my little aphorism about scientists and philosophers? I think that in the end, the Lord intends for us to combine the best of both magisteria, that our goal is, like God, to know everything about everything. It can be very frustrating as a scientist to realize how little we really know about some of the most simple things. Similarly, it's frustrating as a spiritual seeker to recognize that we really don't know enough about God or enough about how He works to predict when a prophecy will be fulfilled, a blessing received, or a prayer answered. It all reminds me of a comment from the guy from whom I took advanced thermodynamics. Believe it or not, this has something to do with faith. He said, the first time I took thermodynamics, I really didn't understand anything at all, but it looked like it had some promise. The second time I took thermodynamics, I really understood everything in it except a few little points. The third time I took thermodynamics, I discovered that I really didn't understand it at all, but by then it was so useful I couldn't live without it. I find that I don't understand physical things well at all, spiritual things well at all, but they're so dear to me now that I refuse to do without them. And when you come right down to it, that's why I say thank you.
Stay alive. Matriarchal blessing. Well, I was born in Salt Lake City, if this were me. Mom called me Precious or Presh in her letters and diaries. Nana Binion said, oh, too bad she's bald. 8 months later, photographed with my two-year-older cousin, I still look bald. What can I say? But Nana took me to the Salt Lake Tabernacle to be baptized, as was done then, and always treated me as someone with potential, as have Mom, my other grandmother, sister, mother-in-law, aunts, sisters-in-law, daughters-in-law, cousins, friends, colleagues, writers, and other blessed women in my life. Now, Nana not only became a teacher, but drove students to school in a horse-drawn buggy. Wife of the first bishop of Nibley Park Ward, she often had depression-caused homeless and hungry people at her door. She helped them all. She bore seven children, raised six, and later guided brigades of young women to become golden cleaners. Google that. One of them bore a woman who became my daughter-in-law. Among other advice, Nana said, get a college degree and work in your profession a while. you can get married anytime. She had many books by and about women. She housed us grandkids overnight, though with a strict curfew, and one of us during many school vacations. At parties, when we asked for more dessert, Nana said, "You've had a nice serving." We knew that even if they were available, we wouldn't get seconds. But we could still stuff ourselves sick from her sideboard-covered nuts and candy. Grandma Myrtle said, "It doesn't matter if your clothes aren't the latest fashion, as long as they are clean, mended, and pressed, and you use your God-given brains and opportunities." For me, it included camping beside her bookcases. She could and did make clothes for her 8 children. She may not have approved of emergency repairs with safety pins and scotch tape, but during World War II gave her ration stamps to buy my shoes. While I was in grade school near her Avenue's apartment, she would invite me for lunch and unlimited black olives. At 19, Myrtle had written, "Oh, how I want to be somebody." Born the same year, 1883, as Nana, she was part of what was termed the New Women Era. With increasing educational and professional opportunities in the U.S., Google it. So, with the highest mark in pedagogy, Google that one too, Myrtle became a teacher, helped her husband through engineering school, and later became vice chair of a political party, which meant she did a lot of luncheons. Before President Hoover's Utah tour, she had enough clout to get the road paved up North Fork of Provo Canyon, at least to Aspen Grove, and may have kept her surveyor husband federally employed for years. Though at 19 she had also written, "I've burned all my earlier diaries. I found enough papers as a graduate student to sketch her life and achievements." This was after crying. My sister and I did the same for Nana and Grandpa Tom. Mom said, "I hope you'll become good enough friends with my friends that when you need help, you'll feel free to ask the nearest. These and others could always come to her," and many did. Some even lived with us during vacation or college. Mom also said, "Study typing and shorthand. You will earn more from knowing them than anything else." Well, having these skills on my resume meant being hired. And because she knew both, she substituted 1 week for me at a law office while I moved it up in Manhattan on a theater tour with my U of U drama class. Among our bookcase titles was Betty McDonald's "Anybody Can Do Anything." Mom and my mom-in-law could do it with fabric, food, carpenter tools, separate stories, and almost anything. After stay-at-home mothering 8 kids and becoming a full-time office worker again, Mom said, "How little a woman earns compared with men's wages." Now, these 4 matriarchs set dinner tables with linen, china, crystal, sterling, which, along with canning, darning, and quilting, I can do to avoid arrest. Only. My mother-in-law Gladys said, "I would never think ill of you." She showed me how to double drape fabric from shoulder to knee to judge whether it was enough for the dress project. And she made clothes for me and sent them to New Jersey, Oregon, Arabia, wherever we lived. She said, "The best hostess keeps her feet and wits moving." Very useful when I was Renew Society president in Saudi Arabia, when women cannot drive and few people had phones. How Gladys wanted to be a teacher. She had sales clerk to save enough to attend the U of U, but because she had had rheumatic fever as a child, education poobahs rejected her on health grounds and suggested general ed instead. Useful, but wasted money, in her opinion. So she reared 5 children, made drapes, clothes, and other things for others, ultimately worked retail again, and died at 82. What do guys running universities know? My sister Judy wrote about me for a 10th grade essay assignment, and let me read it. I looked at her. You say I have an inferiority complex? She said, well, you do. You go around making everyone feel inferior. Judy survived several broken legs and operations, including a recent one mandating wheelchair living for weeks and months. She still teaches piano, takes every possible church job, studies online at BYU. Married at 18, Judy has since born 12 children, reared 11. As of last April, her laws and in-laws totaled 100. Who is inferior? My social worker aunt, who often paid clients' utilities and other bills, said, safeguard yourself first. If alone, carry your keys like brass knuckles. Loop your purse straps over your head, not your shoulder. Never open a purse or wallet to a panhandler. Put in your pocket a dollar or an apple to give, and lock everything. One daughter-in-law said, never put your purse on the seat beside you, but behind your legs, especially in the driver's seat. Another boasted that my daughters-in-law get along better than my sons do. Another made sure her husband includes my husband and me on their cruises. Another valiantly mobilized services for her autistic son and has a gorgeous soprano voice. I take every chance to sing alto with. Now, I haven't detailed these women's testimonies of the gospel of Christ, their devoted family, church, and civic service, including my husband's grandmother in Sweden, who had a soft spot for his mother. But all of this is part of my inheritance as the remaining matriarch to pass on. You see, at Wasatch Lawn Cemetery, I could stand between the gravestones of my grandparents and my preemie grandchildren. Either I'm in the slow group, or I haven't learned it all from them yet. So, but I say, you stay in school and get the highest grades you can, so that through scholarships and part-time working, you can achieve the next diploma debt-free. Study keyboarding, but graphic design. But still, follow your heart into art. History, physical therapy, economics, geology, work in them, and perhaps teach them. Safeguard yourself and your personal information and activities. Socialize far more in face-to-face groups than electronic chats. Learn a second language, study scriptures, and be an example of the believers in word and deed. Go around encouraging and helping and learning from and thanking others. At those all-you-can-eat buffets, keep telling yourself, you have had a nice serving. When operating a motor vehicle, pull over to text or phone. In public, set your cell phones on stun. Nana told me, never say, oh, if only I could do it over again. because you're assuming that you would know everything you had learned and you would do better. And what if you did worse? Why else do I stay alive? Maybe it's to campaign for a posthumous degree in education and a teaching credential for my mother in law. Doubtless, she teaches even more skillfully in heaven. Now, if the academic nobilities can annually give each other and similar public elites all kinds of useless honorary degrees, they could certainly, as apology and amends, create something to honor a woman they had judged inferior at about age 19. Now, the program mentions that I know where the promised land is. It is wherever you are, when you are with your beloved people.
I'd like to thank the accomplishments of all of those who represent Sunstone. From the early days of Scott Kenny to the current honor, to the current leadership of Stephen Carter. Carol, I'm very grateful for you, for Mary Ellen, for Michael, for the rest of the group at Sunstone and all that they've accomplished. That was a very particular, touching message. Love in a time of war. My little grandchild loves Legos. He plays with them day and night with his friends every chance he gets. And he likes little action figures that Legos makes. And he's very, very talented at creating figures. And I think this is very useful for him to be able to learn art. He recently got in the mail a catalog of a new subsidiary of Legos, Hero Factory. And in this, they had a series of heroes and villains, old and young, each with special talents, they were robots, each with special talents, powers, and weapons. And inside was a personalized letter, and it said something like this: "Dear Aaron, due to your hard work, your creativity, and your dedication to truth, we are hereby calling you to join us in the Hero Factory to fight for the cause of justice throughout the world." And he was showing this around to everybody he could find. And I was jealous. More on that later. Why do I stay in Mormon Church? The question assumes that there's something that ought to be driving me out of the chapel doors. So let me ask the question prior to why I stay, which is, why might I be inclined to leave in the first place? Let me give you three possible reasons. First, there's Mormon silence in the face of the great moral issues of our time. When our church leaders do speak, take a stand, they often create genuine embarrassment among loyal Mormons. One example that's particularly close to my heart is the environmentalism. Recently, the University of Utah, a Nobel Prize-winning scientist, spoke and stated that it's the general consensus among biologists that they will be very happy if no more than 25 or 30% of higher animals become extinct, if less than up to that amount, within the next century. We are facing a crisis of not only species elimination, but human suffering. And if we do not solve our environmental problems, we will no longer be a great or a moral nation. Because of its size, growth, and centralization, the LDS Church is in a unique position to provide leadership in the area of renewable energy and environmentalism, if the church is silent. As one leader in the presiding bishopric's office recently stated, "We do not like to be pioneers."
Whoops.
Why would I want to stay in an organization that is silent on the greatest prophetic issue of our time, the respect for all life? A second possible reason for me to leave the Mormon Church is its pervasive and persistent anti-intellectualism. In a recent Temple Recommend interview, my state president yelled at me at the top of his voice when he found out that I was engaged in researching Mormon studies. I didn't mention to him what the topic was, or my methodology or my conclusions. In his mind, the simple fact that I was researching at all was a sign of heresy. This is not an isolated example. The Church has made it clear that it values obedience to power more than the honest and humble search for truth. The Church discourages participation in this open form of Sunstone, which encourages all to listen, consider, and participate. The leaders of the Church have on many occasions refused to even speak to the leaders of Sunstone. Ethical rigor and honest and the humble search for truth are two of the foundation stones for all true religion. I was created with the mind. It is a divine gift. Any leader who demands abandonment of the use of this divine gift of my mind insults its creator. Yes, Virginia, there is a pervasive anti-intellectualism in Mormonism. This leads us to the third reason that might cause me to leave the church in which I was born. The mindset of many church leaders is the mindset of war. I have witnessed the Mormon wars in the trenches, and so have many of you. I am not a pacifist. I believe there's such a thing as a just war. But the current Mormon war seems particularly cruel, abusive, and counterproductive. The Apostle of War, as I call it, is the most powerful man in Mormonism, in the Church of the Prince of Peace. His soul was branded in World War II when he was called upon to fight the allies of Hitler. The Apostle of War has lived his entire adult life with his soul branded as a warrior. I would guess that he had something to do with the granting of an honorary doctorate to Dick Cheney at a time when Cheney was defending the use of torture against America's enemies. He continues his battle today by fighting perceived enemies of the church, intellectuals, feminists, and gays. I do not exaggerate when I state that there are today Mormon spies, there are Mormon interrogators, whose purpose is to intimidate and threaten their fellow Mormons, sometimes acting outside of their line of authority. I know this from firsthand experience. The church will not hesitate to use cruelty against its own members. I do not like the Mormon Wars, but I have not left the Mormon Church. Since I sing each week in my work choir, today I would like to recite verses from the great songbook, the Psalms, as examples of songs of love in an age of the Mormon Wars. Then I will end by revealing to you why it is that I stay. The first song is Lowell Bennion's. I call it Ode to an Imperfect Church. Psalm 46, 8 through 10 reads, "The Lord of armies is with us. He hath caused wars to cease to the end of the earth. The bow he hath broken, and splintered the spear, and chariots burned in fire." While attending the University of Utah as an undergraduate, I read a newspaper article about a Mormon who had been excommunicated for publicly condemning the church for its policy on blacks in the priesthood. After reading the article, I called Lowell Bennion. He invited me to his home, and we had a long talk. Brother Bennion also opposed the church's stance on blacks in the priesthood, but he became more circumspect about his statements. Lowell Bennion told me, "Once you are excommunicated, you lose all influence in the church. If you want to influence the church for the better, stay in the church." These days, things are a little different. An addendum to this might be, if you keep connected to the church, even after excommunication, there are many avenues allowed you to influence the church. So my advice and his advice, stay connected. And I can see here today Michael Levina, Janice, and others who are shining examples of that. There are advantages to loving in the dark days of war. When leaving England in 1620, John Donne wrote, "Churches are best for prayer, which have least light. To see God only, I go out of sight. To escape stormy days, I choose an everlasting night. Put your seer stones in a hat of Mormonism. The darker, the better." The second song of peace in the time of war is entitled the Techniques of Asymmetrical Warfare. Psalm 127 reads, I am for peace, but when I speak, they are for war. We like David are loyal to our Saul life leaders, yet they seek to kill us. We must hide in caves, take advantage of our strengths, and bide our time. We must practice the dynamics of asymmetrical warfare. Like David against Saul, these are the strategies of war for situations in which there's an imbalance of power. The weaker power in war often prevails if they stick to their advantages. George Washington's weak army relied on guerrilla war tactics. They retreated, and they retreated, and they retreated until they gained the victory. The church is stronger and richer and more powerful than any of us here, and they jealously guard their power. They control the conversations in the church. They refuse to talk to us. They do not care to listen. But we have the gift of silent knowledge, the gift of humility, and the gift of second sight. Paul Toscano has taught us the strength of the gift of doubt as well as of faith. These are the gifts of weak power. The ancient sage taught us that water is the weakest of substances, but with time it wears down the hardest rock. Nothing is more powerful than weak water in an asymmetrical war. I do nothing, and all is accomplished. I speak nothing, and my sermon is broadcast. I bury my sword, and I win the battle. The third song of love and war is called The Chains of Hell, or The Evils of Self-Binding. Psalm 126-9 reads, I am like a desert owl in the wilderness, like an owl that lives among ruins. I lie awake and have become like a solitary bird on a rooftop. My enemies taunt me the whole day long. Mad with rage, they conspire against me. I have eaten ashes for my bread and tears with my drink. Do you feel like an owl in the wilderness? Unlike birds, we are social beings, or owls. Yet, emetior estar sozinho do que mal acompanhado. That is, better to be alone than with bad company. Yet am I bound to the church, as my friend Wendy reminds me, because of the Mormon claims to possess an exclusive exaltation? I define exaltation as fullness of joy. So what happens if missteps by the church cause suffering rather than joy? Exaltation is an internal state of peace and joy and perpetual compassion despite circumstances and despite institutional behavior. To say that any institution can create or deny salvation misses the point. The kingdom of God is within you. I bind myself with the chains of hell. Therefore, to be too attached to any institution, no matter how important it is to deny the source of those inner states of happiness that constitute exaltation. While the church may act as a means of salvation and exaltation, for me to be too attached to the means destroys the ends. It does not matter how true the church is, how bonded I am to its heritage, what my family thinks or anything else, if the church is a place of brutality for me, an emotional distance is required for exaltation. This is the paradox of church loyalty. If you wish to be a serious disciple of Mormonism, you must create an emotional distance between you and the institution. If you want to stay, you must be prepared to leave. The next psalm contains an image that illustrates this theme. Psalm 131, 1 and 3. Lord, my eyes are not proud, nor are my eyes haughty, but I am calm and quiet, like a weaned child clinging to its mother. I like the self-contained peace spoke by this psalm. A weaned child is the essence of exaltation. I call it a Buddhist psalm. The Buddhists and Stoics taught that attachment causes universal suffering. I am connected to the church, but not attached to the church. I am connected to all things and attached to nothing. I call the fourth song of love in a time of war, the peacefulness of the big picture. If we put frustrations with the church in their larger context, a broader perspective can bring us insight and peace about our place in the church. Like any means of salvation, the church is morally ambiguous. This empirical fact leads us to postulate an axiom of large institutions, derived from a recent author. Any large institution, no matter how hard the leadership tries, sooner or later becomes ethically constipated and inhumane. This is particularly true of idealistic institutions that expect to be the means of salvation, the arts, medicine, and religion. Because we expect so much of them, they fly too close to the sun and their wings are melted. They fall. This is the Icarus syndrome of large institutions. Out of the most noble institutions necessarily come both the best and the worst of human nature. The church modestly and ambiguously points beyond itself to the greatness that it symbolizes. It is not the greatness itself. It is the child of the manger. This perspective of the Icarus syndrome reminds me not to expect too much of Mormonism. Now I am prepared to answer the question, why do I stay in the Mormon Church? I stay because the Valley View Ninth Ward needs a tenor. Unfortunately for me, tenors are usually the martyrs in the opera. Most of you here are probably too busy planning for your lunch to be able to fit in martyrdom into your schedule. So, as the self-appointed tenor and banjo player for sacrament meetings, ready whenever they want to call me on any rest hymn, let me sing my final song from Walt Whitman. And this is my invitation to you. This is my letter of the Hero Factory. And the words are from Walt Whitman. And I offer them with all my love. Afoot and light-hearted, I take to the open road. Healthy, free, the world before me. A long brown path before me, leading wherever I choose. Henceforth, I ask not good fortune. I am good fortune. Henceforth, I whimper no more, postpone no more, need nothing. Strong and content, I travel the open road. I give you my hand. I give you my love more precious than money. I give you myself before preaching or law. Will you give me yourself? Will you travel with me? Shall we sit by each other as long as we live?
I know this, and so if I get so that I'm too quiet and you can't hear me, please raise your hands. Can everybody hear me right now?
Yeah.
Good. Why I stay, my father, a disgruntled Catholic, and my mother, a self-described Jack Mormon, raised my brothers and me in a basic religion-free zone. We lacked formal religious education, but moral values were emphasized daily. Our home was noisy, with a laissez-faire attitude providing us with the freedom to roam. We were praised for making wise choices and were encouraged towards independence. Our parents unselfishly supported us in the various activities of our choosing. From time to time, I had spotty religious experiences. Probably on Easter when I had a new dress that needed to be seen. When I was 3 or 4, a neighbor invited me to accompany their children to the Presbyterian Church, where I learned to sing, "Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so." I sang this song with conviction, choosing to believe that the kind Jesus loved me. On another Easter occasion, I attended the Baptist Church, but returned home crying with alarming news. Bad men had nailed Jesus to a cross and he hung there for days until he died. My mother's reaction, "Oh my God, you cannot go back." Every summer, the local Burbank YMCA gathered children to their camp in the Tehachapi Mountains for clean, healthy recreation as well as spiritual edification. Y Camp was the highlight of my summer experiences. In the outside chapel, we were surrounded with the wonder of God's forest. As we sang, "How great thou art," we were literally crowned by the blue, blue sky, accompanied by singing birds and the babble of the brook as it was rushing by. Religion, for me, was presented by women whom I adored. I wanted to be like them. I wanted to hike the tallest mountains and set lofty goals. My camp leaders belonged to various religions, so I didn't know which church I should attend when I went back to the valley. I was only 12 when I was trying to choose a church, when my grandmother Anderson stepped up to tell me that I was already a Mormon because I had been blessed there as a baby. I begged my mother to go with me to church. On the day we attended, two young girls my age bore their testimony of the truthfulness of the church. I was amazed, impressed, and hooked. My mother was not. She never returned. I attended church for 3 years before I finally arranged for my own baptism. The following Sunday, as a 15-year-old, I pushed my way through the heavy wooden doors of an unfamiliar ward to begin my life as a new member. I had prayed over the Joseph Smith story in the Book of Mormon. My testimony was firm. I chose to live the high standard set by the church. My course for life was set. Perfect. My life would be perfect. And someday I would enter the temple and it would be the most beautiful experience of my life. 7 years later, leaving my entire family behind, Dean and I entered the Los Angeles temple to be married. Marrying Dean was the most wonderful experience of my life, but the endowment ceremony was confusing and traumatic. I was disappointed and shocked. Shocked that Dean would know my new name, but I would not know his. Shocked that I had to promise to obey my husband. Mostly I was shocked that only Dean would have voice to God. Dean would be positioned as a mediator between me and God. I was confused by scriptures in the New Testament that to me directly contradict this position of women as presented in the temple ceremony. There is neither Jew nor Greek. There is neither bond nor free. There is neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. And for there is one God and one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus. After our wedding ceremony, I felt confused and betrayed. I was so in love with the church and Dean, and I wanted to believe that it was God's one and only true church. In order to make peace with the temple, I told myself that by studying and prayer, I would come to understand the position of women in the ceremony. Everything would continue to be perfect. I pushed it away. As soon as our youngest child entered kindergarten, I began attending institute classes at Mesa Community College. One of my instructors, a Dr. Steve Height, had studied Greek at Harvard. He knew hidden secrets. From him I learned that the inequality of women in the scriptures can be traced to errors in translation. For instance, in our church and most of Christianity, 1 Corinthians 11:3 has been used as a chain of command, with Christ as the head of man, and the man ahead of Christ. Instead, in Greek, when head refers to a man, it means a position of risk and serving others. The husband is the protector, the first to surrender privilege, the first to take risk. The emotional struggle occurring within me finally began to take a toll on my health, so I asked to be released from my position as state primary president. I told Dean I may never hold another church position. I feel good about myself and do not need to be validated by the church. I want off the church treadmill. At the Provo Canyon Women's Retreat, we sang an old Shaker hymn. "'Tis a gift to be simple, 'tis a gift to be free. 'Tis a gift to come down where we ought to be. And when we find ourselves in a place just right, 'twill be in the valley of love and delight." I thought, I want to be simple. I want to be free. I want to come down where I ought to be. I want a place just right. I want to live in the valley of love and delight. For me, leaving the church seemed to be the only way to get to peace and delight. The previous, unthinkable, yet gigantic thought of never again entering the church felt like D deep breathing liberation. Huge, it would be huge. I could comfortably slip back into my previous status of non-member. I knew that life outside the church, I was already surrounded by a wonderful and loving extended family of non-members. Just as I was feeling the righteousness over leaving, I began to doubt my decision. Would my husband, children, and friends still love and accept me? I did not want to take an impulsive leave without serious meditation and prayer. I said this at sacrament meeting, and they all laughed at me for praying about leaving. So I asked God if it would be okay for me to leave the church. Right away, a surprising answer played through my mind. Before leaving, I first needed to find peace in the church. I thought, how ridiculously impossible. Then the idea began making some sense. Wondering where to begin, I prayed again and felt impressed to find local groups of women where I could safely experience spirituality from a woman's perspective. One group I stumbled upon was a group about a whole new way of thinking, a way of life, a whole new way of thinking. Here is an example of new thought. The person or situation that causes one the most grief, despair, and remorse is not the enemy, but one's best friend and teacher. So how does one turn the enemy into best friend and teacher? It's difficult, but amazingly simple. When I come upon discordant situations, I must be humble enough to accept the situation as a learning experience and ask God to help me see how I contribute to the discord. How did this apply to my personal discord with the institutional church? The solution I found was that if I wanted peace, I needed to change myself by giving up my personal battle and forgive the church for not measuring up to my expectations. For peace, I had to realize that I had been so blinded by disappointment and resentment that I failed to appreciate what was good about the church. I failed to witness the damage I was inflicting upon myself and upon others. I learned that I could choose to either live in the darkness of negative thinking, or I could make my list of the church's many admirable qualities and forgive the rest. Forgiveness soothes my soul. It brings me joy and peace. My original goal was to find peace with the church. What I learned instead was to find peace within myself. All along, the institutional church was my teacher and friend. Without my battle with the Mormon church, without forgiveness, I would not have come to enjoy the internal peace I enjoy today. So why I stay? I believe in spiritual mysticism, revelation, and angels, and that it's possible that Joseph Smith was truly a prophet of God. I also believe Joseph Smith was brilliant and spiritually inspired, as well as a rough stump who made mistakes. I have given up on the idea that to be a Mormon, I must know that the church is true. I am comfortable with doubts and conflicting thoughts. I am doing what President Faust said in his last conference address. Follow the noble, intuitive feelings planted deep within your soul by deity. Number two, the church is like family to me. I love the people, and I admire their secure testimonies and truth of the truthfulness of the church. I feel fortunate that I could be in a place where both men and women exert so much energy in trying to be good, reliable, and caring. And I am grateful for the members who accept one such as I. In a 5-day period, I critically read the entire Book of Mormon to see for myself if Joseph Smith could have written it. I concluded that he had spiritual assistance, yet it does not matter to me how it was created. It speaks spiritual messages to me. As I doubtfully read, I felt positively jolted by Amos 32:28, paraphrasing, "If you plant a seed and nurture it in your heart, it beginneth to enlighten my understanding, yet beginneth to be delicious to me." And it did begin. Number four, I stay because church teachings have helped me come to rely on the Savior. When trials have been too heavy for me to bear alone, when I could not handle any more emotional pain or grief, prayer and scripture reading led me to personal revelation. that made me feel like I was lifted into the loving arms of the Savior. I learned what Jesus meant when he said, "My burden, my yoke is easy, my burden is light." I am able, number five, I'm able to remain active in the church because I respect and honor church teachings while at the same time I define me, I define my beliefs, and I define my relationship with the church. Number six, the church no longer disappoints me because I've given up all unrealistic expectations. I simply explore activities outside of patriarchy where my feminine dreams and desires are free to mature. Number seven, some time ago our state president called Deep me into his office to learn why we did not have current temple recommends. I questioned him, "Are you sure you really want to know?" Then, for President Rate, we presented the ways we felt the ceremony was inharmonious with our Christian beliefs. President Rate was unbelievably understanding. He decided to attend the temple so he could specifically listen to what women hear. He went through one session, then straight away he turned around, and for me, he went again. President Great called me back into his office to tell me that he now understood the difficulty I was having, and he suggested that I take to the temple with me all the ways that Jesus Christ treated women equally. Is that not just wonderful? I thanked President Great for loving me and being understanding, and then told him I was going to go to church to love the people and never ever again worry about going to the temple. Because I banished all thoughts about going to the temple from my mind and thought that I never had to think about it again, I never needed to go again, I just wasn't going to think about it, I was able to be at peace during most church meetings. After 2 years of disregarding the temple, it suddenly occurred to me that I might go to the temple for love. I wondered, could I possibly find peace and new meaning in the place that 47 years ago filled me with disappointment and grief. On a Wednesday evening, almost a year ago, I wandered into Bishop Anderson's office for his assessment of my desire to maybe go to the temple. Right away, he put pen in hand over his recommend book, and I said, "Oh no, I do not think you want to give me a recommend. Let's just talk." He smiled warmly and knowingly and proceeded to ask the questions. In the end, I walked away with my pass. The day preceding my temple date, I drove to the temple and parked my bright red SUV in a no parking zone facing the front entrance of the temple. Then, I took many deep, relaxing breaths until I felt spiritually in tune with God, and I prayed, "Dear God, I'm coming here tomorrow morning with my eyes wide open. Please help me have a new spiritual experience in the temple. Surrounded with the love and presence of our two daughters, I entered the temple. During the ceremony, I newly appreciated the spiritual mysticism of creation, of symbols, and of our eternal sacred connection to God and to one another. I felt God's love. For the parts of the ceremony that trouble me, I filled in with the teachings of Jesus Christ. And so it is. I have learned that with God all things are possible. I can create love and peace every day and everywhere. I choose to live each moment in the valley of love and delight."
Toby Hengry for this lovely opportunity. I almost joined his ward in Ithaca when in 1972 I was offered a job teaching at Ithaca College, but went instead to Emporia State in Kansas to teach theater for 27 years. Why do I stay?
But I feel worship most keenly through music. I'll stop here and say I could say amen to everything Mark said to begin with before he talked about being a temple and about the divine word. But I feel worship most keenly through music. So I'll begin with a few musical reasons. I stay because I love to sing like our Welsh pioneers, and I get to do that in my ward and state choirs, but not as robustly as with R. Dean Watts here at Sunstone. I still sing out to the bass line in sacrament meeting too, but sadly there, when I sing out, I stick out in today's correlated climate. Incidentally, my wife Jimmy is here today, and we have a second marriage. We lost both our spouses to cancer, and then 13 years ago we found each other and got married. And our first day in her ward together, after I moved back to Utah after Kansas, we had a brother invite us to stay for choir practice. And at the same time, I said yes, and she said no. She had not sung in a ward choir, and I had always sung in a ward choir. Well, the next Sunday, she came along with me, and we've been singing in a ward choir ever since, and that's been great fun. I stay also for the chance to lead the opening hymn in priesthood meeting. Luckily, with Brady Allred, sometimes at the piano. And since as an old actor, I can impersonate R. Dean pretty well, that's one place a small group of LDS men can really ring the rafters. I was born in the Holy Cross Hospital, now Salt Lake Regional. My foxy young mother turned 21 while we were there following my birth. My father was just a few months older, and they had eloped one evening a couple of years earlier when my dad had a rare day off working for Charlie Snellgrove at his ice cream store. My prenatal diet had been a nightly double-thick chocolate malt made with Canadian vanilla. That explains a lot about me, by the way. Both fiercely independent young party animals, not prone to church activity once out of their teens, Mom and Dad were wheedled soon by my father's faithful parents into a subsequent temple sealing so that their children, starting with me, would be born in the covenant. My early memories were of loving and mostly attentive parents who would drop my younger sister and me off at Dad's folks' house on Saturday evening and then go join their freewheeling friends. Grandma and Aunt Ellen, having rustled up and even purchased appropriate clothing to keep on hand for us, mumbling the while, would take us to church on Sunday. Pressure for weekday primary came later, and bungalows somehow got filled. As some of you younger folks won't relate to that, but you can ask some of your older friends what that means. I always knew that my dad was a smoker, but one day Sammy Brooks, who lived across the street in Sugar House, told me, "Your mother smokes too, I saw her. She does not, does too, does not, does too." And so the doubt was planted. Was Mommy a closet smoker? Despite our being sent to Sunday school rather than taken, Dad always seemed wiser and gentler, and Mom the cynic. I remember her knocking President Heber J. Grant for being so tough on those who drank coffee, the smell of which I loved in our house. And when President Grant died and Mrs. Peterson across the street wept, Mom made fun of her and just couldn't understand why the tears. And yet I remember how Mom loved reading, spent hours at her own old upright piano learning a difficult Rachmaninoff piece, had a joyful, contagious laugh, wrote and recited really witty verse and was clever and loving. One day when Mother and I were the only ones at home, not long after Sammy Brooks had dropped his little bomb, she had a girlfriend come to visit, and I was sent on what felt like a phony errand to the Sugar House Bakery. So I agreed, but when I opened the front door to leave, I couldn't help myself. With the doorknob in my hand, I turned and asked, "Mom, are you sending me to the bakery because you want to have a cigarette with Olive?" I could tell the question stunned her, but she looked in the eye for a moment and said, "Yes, I think I'd like that, Ronnie." And I said, "You don't have to send me away." I was about 9 or 10, so I sat with Mom and Olive and watched them light up, and it just about killed me, but I tried hard not to show it. About the same time, Dad and I learned to ski together. I was 9 and he was 30, and since he worked 6 days a week at Ben Franklin's store as manager, Sunday was our ski day with Harry Orne, our funny Swedish neighbor. And when I turned 12 and the bishop ordained me a deacon, I had a dilemma and told Dad I couldn't go skiing on Sunday with him anymore. I could tell he was frustrated and proud of me all at the same time. He had been an active Aaronic priesthood boy himself, and I was told he'd been angry with his father when, earlier in the Depression, Grandpa had decided to send Dad's divorced brother on a mission rather than him because there wasn't money to do both. And ultimately, when I was 15, my father decided to devote himself to church service, and my mother tried for a while to go along with him. This felt like a sort of Camelot period in our family. It coincided with my becoming very pious indeed, and I took credit for bringing them around, as my grandfather Frederickson once predicted. My father, who had not ordained me a deacon or a teacher, did ordain me a priest and an elder, and when I served in the British mission under A. Hamer Reiser, it was a lovely experience, partly because President Reiser was a wise and moderate man who wanted us to assimilate British culture and history, as well as do the Lord's work. I loved it when he recited Wordsworth's Daffodils on at least 2 or 3 occasions, and I was glad he was more a poet and historian at heart than a sales manager. When I returned and found my mother had never stopped drinking coffee the whole time I was a missionary, I got on my Hyde Park soapbox and said some very silly and unkind things to her, and I blush at it now. Because though I choose to obey the word of wisdom as currently taught, I no longer consider those who don't sinners. And I can't help wondering that if Leah Witzel hadn't made such a big deal over caffeine in her 1935 book, and President Grant hadn't gone along with it, we might have 20 million or more members these days instead of 14. And we'd still be almost as peculiar. And so I stay to find chances to avoid saying more silly and unkind things. I stay because I have a sister with one straight child, one gay child, and one transgender child. And I have dozens of former and current gay students. And I want the perspective of an involved LDS person when I express honest disagreement with my church's overweening official activity in California's Proposition 8. I'm 76, and undoubtedly too old, but I still long to see the day when our gay brothers and sisters feel comfortable and accepted while sitting holding a partner's hand in one of our sacrament meetings. And so I say to give voice to those feelings. I say to continue to be a friend and a sounding board to parents of gay children in my ward who have privately expressed thanks when I've been gently vocal in response to insensitive homophobic comments made in church meetings. I take courage from my conservative high priest group leader, a good friend who phoned me one Sunday morning when I was scheduled to give the priesthood lesson. He'd been assigned by the bishop to ask for volunteers to call any friends and relatives in California and encourage them to vote for Prop 8. He knew I wouldn't volunteer, but didn't want me blindsided by the announcement and have affect my lesson negatively. Knowing his feelings on the issue, his respect for mine touched me. As you'll recall, our leaders withdrew that Utah telephone and email initiative within hours. So I think our voices can be heard when we speak with love. Why else do I stay? Frankly, for some whimsical reasons that make me a bit of a snob. I know that we're encouraged to set an example of obedience and righteousness, and I think that's usually good. However, there are other kinds of examples I like to set, and being an old college professor, I stay to model some un-Mormon-like behaviors I consider desirable. I refuse to use the word awesome. And neat. And special. And appreciate without the first syllable. And where possible, even the word fun. I'm grateful to have been a missionary before flip became an expletive. We could extend the list, but I'll stop there, except to add the unrelated observation that I'm grateful even to have been a pre-name tag elder. I stay to model other linguistic behaviors that will likely have no effect at all, but which I think would be preferable to quirky and predictable habits of Mormon speak. I've written a little verse to illustrate the first. Here it is. Brigham Young is among the first who became a high church official without the obligatory middle initial. I believe that in most cases, our church talks, our comments in class, our interaction with each other on church-related topics would all be much less stilted and more conversational if our references to church leaders did not always contain their middle or first initials. I noticed some of that today, by the way. You know, Neil Maxwell, that was great to hear, without the A. For example, in conference yesterday, I loved Brother Boyd Packer's comment when he said, I don't know how many of you would say something like that. Or Elder Marlon Jensen really moved me this afternoon. We used to be more informal in our name references when I was growing up. But there are some glaring exceptions. David McKay sounds funny without the O. And Ezra Benson needs his Taft. But in the last 25 or so years, we seem to have developed a sense of institutional guilt about any omission of those initials. And I'm guessing many of our leaders would welcome less hero worship and more informality when we refer to them. I stay to model a related example in conversation by referring to our current president most frequently as President Monson rather than as the prophet. For two reasons. First, out of deep respect for the sacredness of a prophetic calling, and secondly, because I grew up rarely hearing that usage. And so it feels a bit pious to me in someone's mouth. For me, it was always President Grant, President George Albert, President McKay, President Joseph Fielding, President Kimball. In Brigham's day, I hear it was even Brother Brigham, in part because for years President Young refused to be referred to as prophet following Joseph's assassination. I stay because the longer I live, the more I love and need Doctrine and Covenants 46, 11 through 14. For all have not every gift given unto them. To some is given one, and to some is given another. To some it is given by the Holy Ghost to know that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and that he was crucified for the sins of the world. To others it is given to believe on their words, that they also might have eternal life if they continue faithful. Some zealous members counter with, but elsewhere we're told that we can't always live on borrowed light. And if that's true, I may well be in trouble. I don't use the phrase "I know" these days because I know less than I felt I once did about the restored gospel. I'm content to depend on the borrowed light, and I'm very dependent on mercy and grace and that good old word, strive. How well a striver I am, only the Lord knows. I'm fond of saying that I grew up in a more interesting church than I attend now. B.H. Roberts and O.C. Tanner and even Reuben Clark's lesson manuals were much more stimulating than the correlated stuff we have today. And those Relief Society literature lessons were a breath of fresh air. I navigate between falling asleep in sacrament meeting or during a general conference talk and then sitting 5 minutes later with tears brimming in my eyes, grateful I can still feel the Spirit. I navigate between embarrassment over our poor support for theater arts, unless it's church-sponsored, and joy in joining in a welfare canning assignment, or pride about the humanitarian outreach among the world's needy and afflicted. I stay because I feel it can be just as arrogant to arrive firmly at fraudulent conclusions about the prophet Joseph as it is to accept everything he said and did without question. In a 1992 wine and cheese crowd in Kingsbury Hall containing many a likely doubter who were anticipating a lecture on Joseph Smith by Yale University's Harold Bloom, they were surprised as he spoke in part the following words: "I have centered necessarily on the religion-making genius of Joseph Smith. If one decides that Joseph Smith was no prophet, then one's dominant emotion towards him must be wonder. There is no other figure remotely like him in our entire national history, and it is unlikely that anyone like him can ever come again. Most Americans have never heard of him, and most of those who have remembered him as a fascinating scamp or charlatan. I myself can think of not another American who so moves and alters my own imagination. So self-created was he that he transcends Emerson and Whitman in my imaginative response and takes his place with the great figures of our fiction, since at moments he appears far larger than life, in the mode of a Shakespearean character, so rich and varied in personality, so vital a spark of divinity, is almost beyond the limits of the human as normally we construe those limits. I end as I begin with wonder," he continues. "We do not know Joseph Smith, as he prophesied that even his own could never hope to know him. He is as enigmatic as Abraham Lincoln, his contemporary. But even if we do not know Lincoln, we at least keep learning what it is we cannot quite understand. But with Joseph Smith, we cannot be certain precisely what baffles us most. As an unbeliever, I marvel at his intuitive understanding of the permanent religious dilemma of our country. Our deep need for originality gave us Joseph Smith, even as it gave us Emerson and Emily Dickinson, Whitman and Melville, Henry and William James, even as it gave us Lincoln, who founded our all but all-powerful presidency. There is something of Joseph Smith's spirit in every manifestation of the American religion. I just can imagine those people sitting in Kingsbury Hall with their jaws dropped. I don't know what they were expecting from Harold Bloom, but I recommend to you his book, The American Religion, if you haven't read it. Many of you, I'm sure, have in this group. But published by Simon & Schuster in 1992. I close with one last musical reason for staying. I hope to live long enough for the publication of our next hymnal to see if the Music Correlation Committee, if that's what it's called, puts Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing back in it. It was number 70 in the old brown or navy blue hymn book, and it was taken out of the green edition, but the current Mack Wilberg arrangement, now a major work by which the Tabernacle Choir is recognized, and the title of which is also the title of a best-selling CD, gives me hope that it might be restored to us. I have a private theory about why such a marvelous hymn was omitted from our 1985 hymnal. Some prayerful correlator, thinking to do us a favor, chanced on the following line in the lyric, which I'm guessing got the hymn thrown out. Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. Since that lovely true line often reflects my own dilemma, I stay so that I might find strength for the next and final line. Here's my heart. Oh, take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above. The time has been well spent, I'm sure you feel, and why don't we applaud the group again and we'll leave.